Three in the same book.
Is it yours?
Yeah, no, it's yours.
Ah, okay.
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a little bit.
All right, so I have a subject with 2 points, I don't know. Yeah, basically, the problem was this category, this partial order category, when everything was like missing. Basically, we have already considered that example, I don't remember if it was done properly.
Yeah.
So that was the point of the exercise, to see that there are categories which are very different from the usual ones. So it's not like set, it's not like CPUs, and of course there are no things like points, because the whole category is just many points, but these points are objects and they are not elements. So, and morphisms are also, they're just one kind of morphisms. So, and either exists or it doesn't. Right. So there was this solution. So what I'm proposing is that we maybe do the exercises still for an hour, and then switch to some new stuff. So, and what I wanted to ask you, maybe you present your solution on this that inductive proof.
Okay.
Because I think it's very nice, and one can learn something from it.
Okay. No, it's just pretty messy in there.
I thought there are many colors, and you can choose which one you want.
The light
or the light?
I don't know.
Okay. Okay. So basically, the idea was that list is an inductive set. So lists over X. So we say that the empty list is always a list. Whenever I have an element of X and a list over X, I get a new list by putting one element in front of by putting the element in front of the list. Okay, and then part of the exercise was first to then define a monad from this. So we said that e per x of x is just a singleton list. And this is just the list you get from this construction by taking the empty list and putting x in front of it, and then we define the classic stuff, but what we first need is concatenation. And for this, I introduce the symbol plus with a circle around it. And so the thing is, with this inductive structure of the lists, we can also define functions on them inductively. And so we just have to say what we get when we concatenate an empty list with some list, and what we get when we concatenate a non-empty list with such a list. So if we give these two, we have concatenation as a well-defined function on lists. And the definition is pretty much straightforward. So this works like that. And with this, we can define a Pleissen star. And so we say that function f, which goes from x to the list over y, we can then define f star, which goes from the list over x to the list over y. And then we can use the same principle. We can define this by saying what f star is on the empty list and what it is on a non-empty list. So we say f star of the empty list that would just be the empty list, and f star on a constructed list is then given by we can first take f of x, and f of x is a list over y, and f star of x is also a list over y of x's. So what we then can do is concatenate those two, which is why we defined this beforehand.
Right, so it's an inductive definition then. I wonder if this is how it's defined in Haskell, trying to find out the implementation of the monads, of the monad operations of the lists.
Well, this is just concat map. I think there is a function concat.
Yes, but concat is not the Pleissen star.
Yeah, but there is also a function concat map.
Yes.
As far as I know,
which does what?
And I think that's precisely the Pleissen star. I might be wrong, but.
Yes, it's a Pleissen star, but how it's defined.
Yeah.
So it has its own definition.
Yeah. And I'm not sure either if the Pleissen star is just defined to be concat.
Defined in GSC list, so it may be just low level defined. Yeah, basically, yeah, it's defined in terms of Poulter.
Okay.
And, yeah. But essentially it's a similar definition if you define it from scratch, but then Pleissen star also is inductively defined.
Okay, so with these definitions, what we then do next is verify the monad laws. And the first one is the one the eta star is the identity. And then again, the nice thing about these inductively defined functions is that we can reason about them with inductive proofs. So these two are functions which go from the list over X to itself. To show that the functions are the same, we show that they are the same on every list. And to show that they are the same on every list, we can do an inductive proof. So we show that they agree on the empty list, and then we show that if they agree on two lists, and we concatenate. So if they agree on a list, and we put an element in front of it, that they then agree on the new list. So we have some inductive proofs, and then so we get the inductive base, which is eta star of the empty list is just, well, we use this definition, so it's the empty list, and that's of course the identity function applied to the empty list. And then the inductive step is if we have eta star of some non-empty list, then we first apply this definition and we get so that this is eta of x concatenated with eta star of x's. And then we can apply the definition of eta, which is up there. So that's a singleton list with x. And here we can use the induction hypothesis and say that, well, this is just x's. And then it's straightforward to see that this is just the same as x put in front of x's. So we could in fact show this by saying, okay, well, this is the same as this, and then we use the definition of concatenation and arrive at this equation with two or three more steps. Okay. So the next monad law was the one about combining a star with eta. So here we don't even need an inductive proof because these are just functions defined on x. So if we have f star of eta of x, then this is just f star of the singleton list with x. And this is this is f of x concatenated with f star of the empty list, which in turn is just the empty list. But wait. Oh yeah, that's right. And that's just f of x, because concatenating with the empty list from the right yields just the same list. And again, we could prove this inductively, that's pretty straightforward. Okay, so the final law is the one
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. Basically, you could deal with the other ones easily anyway.
Yeah.
But here's this this really shows the power of this approach of inductive definitions, because here you can really show it without any handwriting strictly.
Okay, actually, I had to include a lemma, so I think it would be better to start with the lemma.
Yes.
The lemma is which looks like this. So basically, it's some kind of distributive law for F star. And how are we going to prove it? Well, of course, we're going to prove it inductively. So, and we're going to do this by induction on axes. The inductive base is that. Well, concatenating with the empty list from the left, of course, yields just the right argument of the plus. So this one holds, and then for this one, we just have to see that, well, this is again just the empty list. So of course, we can also write this. Okay, so the inductive step. Let's see, we have F star of a non-empty list concatenated with Y's. And then by definition of concatenation, we can say that this is just the same as adjoining the element X to this X's plus Y's list, and then we can use the inductive definition of the star to say that this is the same as f of x concatenated with f star of x plus y's. Okay, and now the next step is to use the induction hypothesis. Now we're going to have to use that the list concatenation is associative, which is yet another fact about lists which can be proved in an inductive manner. So
but we are not going to dig so deep into the foundations of lists.
Yeah, well,
so
I thought this was going to be too much.
Yes, that would definitely be too much.
This is again F star of X is a trunk of X. So that proves the lemma. And with this, we can then tackle the Monod law. Okay, see. Okay, so first we're going to do the base of the induction, which is going to be G star F star of the empty list is just G star of the empty list, which is the empty list, which is G star composed with F star of the empty list. So nothing too spectacular there. And then for the inductive step, we say, well, let's suppose we have G star S star of x axis. Then this is just G star of f of x concatenated with F star of x's. And this is the point where we use the lemma. So this is G star of F of x plus G star of F star x's, and then we can use the inductive hypothesis for the right side. So this is G star of f of x concatenated with G star f. R of x's, so yeah, and see. Oh, okay, and we can also say, well, this is G star, so this is the same function applied to x, the one inside the star. So this is just by definition of the star, the same thing as G star composed with F star applied to X axis, which is what we wanted to show. Yeah.
Yep.
So this cool. Proves the third moment of the time.
Cool. Okay, any questions about the course? So I think we're done with it. Right? So then we can do some of the fifth one. We started the first exercise and some Hans Götter showed the one of the unit laws. Well, yes, in the meta language. So this exercise is quite shaky because it's not very well formulated. Basically, the idea was here to summarize some common knowledge about the fact that you can do many proofs in a meta language, and this is usually more convenient as using the Gregorian language because you avoid the strings, etc. So it's some folklore knowledge which I tried to summarize here, but apparently not very well. So the theorem should state that it's equivalent to switch from monads to the meta language. So basically, I've stated the equivalence here, and so there's a paragraph saying that it's if we do give a semantics in terms of psi and phi, and this semantics happens to satisfy the monad laws, this means that the you can define the monad structure using the assignments below, and that's gonna be a monad. And that holds conversely, if you're if this assignment defines a monad, then the monad was as it is there. So, and then I basically reformulated one part of this and simplified, but the simplification is quite non-trivial. So, but I mean, since I've stated that, you just can use it. So basically, instead of showing that well, you start with some phi and psi, and then eta, star, and tau defined like this, generating monad, so that this implies that the monad laws are satisfied. So what one can prove instead, so that's the point of the simplification, if psi and phi are in the first place defined standardly, so like I showed in the lecture, and then the monad laws are satisfied.
There's a chalk.
Where?
There's a chalk here on the table.
No, but
the
whiteboard.
I think this is designed with the idea in mind that the people move more, so the chalk is there, the tempo is there, so we go back and forth. So basically, we just assume for the direction which is indicated in the first one. So we assume that we get this semantics, xp, q, t, say. And this is. So basically, this means that we choose phi of fg equal to star tau id, okay. And on the xi equals eta tau f. So that's what I call standard interpretation. So that's what we usually do. We assume a moment, but the point of the theorem was that suppose that there is no moment, but there is something instead of it, and that something generates the semantics which satisfies the moment laws, and then one can derive the moment out of it. So, but for that direction that we propose to stick to, let's assume that phi and psi they are like this, and let's prove the missing law. So I propose that someone does it, because so we did one unique law, and there was one other unique law left. Does someone remember which we proved? So then was this one. Red X?
Yeah, that's what we proved.
Okay, so let's prove another one. Red T Q is equal to Q, and okay. So now I immediately notice that the type of the problem
y gets 2x gets
b. Yes, okay. Yes. So the problem is here, of course, that I would again need a lemma about the substitution, which I didn't, I think I didn't introduce. So let's just postulate the lemma, and well, someone who does it can use it. Alright, so what we do here, we basically calculate G And then as a round, G applied to composed with ID and F. Yeah. That is called substitution lemma. So that's basically a standard property of this equational calculus, which is basic and it must hold. And that's something one can prove by induction of the semantics. So maybe it would make sense to prove it. But maybe it's going to be a bit tedious. Maybe I just prove several clauses of it. So proof. Or Q. So Q is a term, it has certain size, and what you have to do here is we'll just do a case distinction, consider all the cases how Q can be constructed, and call the induction hypothesis in the serial places. So first clause would be like this, basically. If we have Q equal to X, well, let's try it like this. Yeah, or I could just write Q equal to X. Then what we have here, we have on the left hand side X PX B, which is equal to this. Alright, so here if we assume that Q is equal to X, then beta is equal to B. So then I can write A. So and then this is just equal to F. Then what else we have to calculate? We have to calculate x a of x alone. Because it's our g. So it's just equal to PR2. So using the semantic rules, we assume that we bracket everything to the left. So hence this is a projection. And therefore this is equal to F which is equal to. So I think I.
Well, that's just the same as the projection.
Okay, sure. So, thank you. So it's a projection that y is here, and this is our g. So, right, another case would be like if this x is some other x, so then this substitution is vacuous. So if we calculate the projection, if we calculate the substitution, then this would disappear and we would have some other variable here. So this would evaluate to some projection. And on the other hand, that would be the same projection. So we would project, this projection would go somewhere inside, and F will be discarded. So there are many other cases like this. Maybe you have got some wishes about which case I should consider. So which case would be interesting? I think the binding would be interesting, right? Because binding is the one which creates, which acts on the contexts. So, and that's a place where it's a little bit not obvious. So then we have what we have on the other, on the one hand again, A, Q, 2 times B. So we make use of the semantics there, and we get tau applied to. It's not going to be gamma, it's going to be gamma x a and y of type c probably. So what's the type of S? The type of S is C or TC. And this is TB. This is also TB. Right? So let's also call it not including the star. Let's call it H. And let's call it W. And then we have to check this thing. Alright, so this is not B, let's call it B prime. Because B is the output type for Q, but when I'm saying that Q is of this form, then B must be of type B prime or some B prime, because it's a computation. So let me do Q2. And what we get then, so let me substitute it. My Q is concrete, it's like this. So I have 2YS where I substitute X and then T. So we're assuming here that y is not equal to x. Otherwise, this clause is going to be modified a bit because we wouldn't substitute here because it would be shadowed by this binding. Okay, and then we apply the semantics here. So we again calculate this gamma YC and then C. So here we can apply the induction hypothesis 2 times. Because of this, so G is a semantic of Q. So I think I've got H applied to ID and yeah. So we'll just write it down, let's see if it makes sense. And it's here we've got probably W applied to ID and no. Oh, yes. So does it actually type? Thank you. So there is a subtlety here, right? Because this is our age, but we want to substitute x and not y. So that's modulo permutation of the context. So in fact, strictly saying, we cannot apply this lemma, so we have to strengthen the assumption saying that this x need not be the last x, as maybe from somewhere from the middle, which is precisely the case here, because so I'm substituting this x in t, and this x is not the last x, so it's the one before. So I just want to gloss over it, and specifically, I'm just going to modify my context. So basically, at this place, I have got what? Gamma, and then W returns me C. So at this place I get gamma C, and what F returns? A. And I need AC. So basically, I need to include some permutation function here, which would basically swap these two elements here. So is that? Maybe just call it swap. Right, so this is induction hypothesis, but it's an induction hypothesis not for H, but for H prime, where these two things are swapped. So that can be made work. Basically, the same argument applies, because if you switch to variables, then the complexity of the term is the same. So this induction should be valid. So what swap does, swap goes from gamma times C times A to gamma times C times A. And it works in an obvious way, and specifically swap is equal to
but that would just be a social community.
Yes.
Right, but we pretend we also exchange the order of the.
Ah, yes. Actually, yes. It's not associativity. It's. No, sorry. You're right. So the order is the same. It's really a swap. So, no. The order is the same, but it's different in both sides. So we have gamma times C times A to gamma times A times C. Okay? Yeah. Correct? At least these types, right? So solo perchance listing and H. So that's precisely what H is expecting. So right, we have to return gamma times A here, which means this is just projection to 1 times AD on this side, and on the other side it's projection to 1 composed with projection to 2. So this projection to first, and then projection to the second, and this is how you get C. And for this, you basically take the first projection here, which is gamma, and take ID on the right, which is A. So that's the explicit definition of set. But of course, if you just look at the type, it's clear what it does. And this is if you write it down in the table. So then let's continue the calculation. Maybe instead of continuing, we can start from the other side. So this was the substitution side, and we have to compare it with the semantics of Q. So basically it's this. Right, so I need to show that this thing is equal to this thing, because this thing is precisely the right hand side here. Instead of G, I take the concrete semantics, so that I can rewrite a bit and obtain what? So the semantics of T, for which I have a letter, so it's H composed with tau, which is star, composed with tau, composed with AD, and composed with the semantics of S, for which I also have a letter, V, and this is all composed with ID F. So now I can so I can pull something inside the brackets, right? And mainly we can get this and DF.
with a comma in front of the W.
Ah, yes, thank you. So this this can be moved to up to the front of the strings because strings is nature. So let me just write down the equation, and then actually I can probably do it in stages. So I get 8*τ. Is it still readable? So, and then basically they can single this out. So id times f times ad, and there we get id w id f. Right, because this thing returns me here. And this thing applies this to the left component of this pair and this to the right component of the pair. So I can collapse this expression by just putting this in the first place and this at the second. And the IDs will disappear. So that's why these two expressions are equal. And then I can distribute this thing. So, and I also write AT here. So, because T of ID is ID. So, and then I can write it like this, H* times T ID F. Enclosed with W ID. This is the naturality of T. Of tau. Right, because what naturality says, it says if you have that T some pair of functions f tg to a prime times t, and the strings here, alternatively apply strings here, and then you get a right, so this is naturality of strings, and that's precisely the situation we have here, because here is tau applied to a pair. So tau applied to a pair, and this is now pair under t applied to tau.
The tau somehow went missing, but
yeah. So now it's quite similar, isn't it? Right, so we've got this expression and that expression at the bottom, they're almost the same. So this tail with tau id, etc. is the same one as there. So we've got just these two things which are different. Let's check them. Well, basically, I can continue this calculation. Because, so I can also put this t under the star. I don't know if we probably didn't prove anything like this. So there's a law, f star tg is equal to fg star. That's the law which I'm going to apply now, because that's what simplifies it. But that's, we didn't have it before. Okay, so that's actually a lemma which is needed here. Why it's true? Well, because we know that the functor action is expressible via the star in eta. So we've got eta star, g star. And then we use one of the laws saying that this is equal to this. And then it's equal to fg star. So hence we can get h, and then f times id. So, and this must be equal to h swap idf. So I believe this is something one can see basically by, well, I can start writing on this side. Because swap has a concrete definition, so I can substitute it here. Instead of swap, I take this thing, PR 1 times PD, PR 2 times PR 1, swap times ID, yeah. So here I take so we believe this PR1 R2
Interesting.
Something doesn't work, right? So something for doesn't type check. So again, what effort runs? Effort runs A. So this would be A. So I've somewhere lost one another peer one. So there must be a peer one before F. Then or not, this wouldn't help. So if we just wanted to write this thing, it would be PR1. That's equivalent. So wait, now I have just lost it somewhere. So there must be yet another peer one before F. I don't know where it's lost. One should check the types I currently can find out. I don't know. Didn't notice where this is happening. Right. So anyway, that was the hardest case. So the other ones are simpler. I did not try to check it offline. Need to take a picture of the board. Anyway, so that was the lemma which one needs for proving the thing. And. Right. Did anyone try to prove it? Did you try to prove it?
Yeah.
And did you need the same one?
I think so. There was one in the script.
In a different script?
Yeah, no, in a different formulation. right?
Okay, so yes. Yeah, okay. but I still it wasn't provable. Yeah, but that's okay. At least I told you about it. At least I didn't forget that. Right. So you can. So this formulation was the sound about the soundness. So it's something you can prove on the equational calculus. So and. Basically, we are now justifying that the equational calculus is correct. It is sound. So the fact that substitution lemma is a provable principle wouldn't help you here, because here you need it on the semantics level. So before we prove that the equation is sound with respect to semantics, we cannot just use this principle from there. We need counterparts of them. Okay, so is it too late?
I don't know. I think I only have one proper write up of it and I gave it to you. Do you have it with me?
Yes. I did check it yet. Which email? So maybe wait, I take a picture of the board because I'm interested in where the glitch is. Something that we do quite regularly. Might be quite readable from there. Okay. Thank you. this too.
In general, it could be TV, right? Okay, so then this was just this one we could just use the definition of phi for, and this in turn so we had we only have phi of fg, so I guess we can just add this line. So we have this is phi of so this is phi applied to this FMG. And now we can just use this definition to say, okay, this is G star composed with tau composed with the identity on gamma, and then we have this F, but this F the term in here is a red term, so we use the psi, and so we get that this is the same as beta A composed with with the semantics for T.
So perhaps you could call that later thing F, because there was an F in
the previous one. Perhaps that's better. So let's say this is F. Then we do the same idea as before. We split this and we get the identity on gamma cross beta A. And then we have that gamma paired with F now.
Yeah, and then supposedly some diagram applies,
right? Right. So we get that this thing is in fact the same as eta gamma cross A. And then the next thing. okay, so now we have a star and an eta, so this is just G composed with a pair of identity in F.
Yeah, and now you're done by the lemma, right? Assuming that you have it.
Yeah.
So this, what you obtained is just the semantics of the right-hand side, provided you have the level.
So these G and F are exactly G and F from the lemma, and so we get this. P substitute for X. Yeah.
Right, this is it. If you know the lemma, of course.
Yeah.
I think it's also possible without the lemma.
Really?
I cannot define things. If we are basically abstracted by context gamma and then I applied it. And then by the definition of application, you get this substitute.
Yeah, well, so the problem is this may not work because abstraction doesn't work.
Why?
Because we do this all in generic category, in a generic category.
Okay, I see.
Yeah.
I can't assume that composition is defined as simple.
You may not be able to write things like lambda, because what is lambda? This is indeed good that you notice it, because precisely all this calculation is to a large extent so difficult is because we want to do them, to have them in categories, not beyond sets. Because in sets, as I mentioned, every moment is strong, so you can simplify everything because you don't need to mess up with the strings at all. Because a string is basically some lambda expression, and if you do the calculation in sets, you may not notice at all that you need strings because you just use this lambda abstraction and the calculations with lambda without noticing that there's something fundamental around there. But that's just because we're on sets. And if we are not on sets, it all becomes like this. And this is something that you do not notice from Haskell, as I also said. But so that's my problem. I do not. I didn't have a very good idea how to present it better because I hesitated if I wanted to involve the strings. But if you don't involve the strings, then basically you need to somehow make do without it every time, and then you cannot prove, for example, that it's reasoning in terms of do is equivalent in reasoning about the strings. So I don't know how to avoid it, and without just eliminating lots of theoretical business from this course away. So if we eliminate the strings, we would need to change the course in such a way that it's going to be more or less a passing course. I don't know. I will try to present this better somehow. So, well, all right. Then I wanted to tell a little bit about some new stuff. Do the rest of these exercises next time. And what I was going to tell about is basically yet another moment. So here again hesitated if we want to have it or not, but here for another reason. Basically we have considered quite a few moments which represent computations, and allow one to deal with them in a cultured way. So there is a way to do it remote Mario culture. But that's an important concept. I think it should belong to this course. So I would like to introduce it therefore. So it's called conciliation moment. I don't know if you heard about it, maybe you used it. Yes. So there's the whole programming style, which is called continuation facing style, which is which implicitly uses continuation moment. Like if you do scheme or something like that, there are so-called continuations which are used as cross-class citizens. It means that you're using them like any other object. So they are available, like functions, for example. Basically in Haskell, they are explicit. You may use them explicitly as part of a continuation moment. If you don't want to use them, you don't use them. And I don't want to use them most of the time, but there is such an option. It exists if you want to do continuation placement style programming. That basically that's what you're after. And we do it in sets again. So that's our non-fair assumption, because in Haskell we have abundant sets, but we just do it for simplicity and to be able to do reason with lambda and not to do the strings. And then we define t of x equal to x to r. So this is something not very obvious, and so the intuition about it this type encapsulates results, and this thing is the type of continuations. So the idea of the computation with the continuation monad is that, okay, I give you something which knows what to do if you have a result, and you are using this to produce the result. So it's quite difficult to adapt yourself to this sort of reasoning. In particular, you can write very unreadable code if you really use it extensively. So, what the monad structure here, it's like this. So, basically, the way to convert a value into a computation is request a continuation and call this continuation with your value. So it's kind of predicate. You may think about it as a predicate. It's a generalized predicate, and you're given a predicate saying which can measure if you have a certain property or not. And if you have an element, you just give the answer by calling this predicate, which will determine that. What else? There is the Gillespie store, which looks like this. So f goes from x to right, so this is my sum f, and this is my sum p from r to x to r. So what this is supposed to be, this is something which takes a computation from y to r, and okay, maybe one can see that here what one can do is there's not so much. So we've got a continuation of this type from y to r. What we can do with this, okay, so there's some candidate here to call it with. So it's something that the function f will return, but to get it, we need to know some x. So how we do it, we just pretend that we have some x. So we just start some lambda expression, extraction expression, and if we start it, then after that we have some x. So we call this f with this x, and then we obtain the function that we want, in which we can feed the continuation. And now the thing, the whole thing will be of type x to r. And this is precisely what p is expecting. Right, so this is not at all obvious how it works and why it's like this. Well, actually one can say something already here, I think. So basically we want to have to tell how the lifting works, how the crescent composition works, and we are given a continuation. So we basically use this f as a thing which transforms the continuation, and then we obtain a new continuation and feed it to P. So we essentially calculate backwards. So normally we first, if we have an application f of P, so we first apply the argument to something, and then we apply f to the result which we obtained by P, and here it's all upside down. So we first feed the continuation to the function, and then create another continuation and feed it to the argument. So I'm gonna do two things at the same time. I'm gonna prove that it's a monad, and at the same time maybe better explain its meaning. implies the category CT is up to ISO more crazy. So the continuation one is a monad, and its coercive category is up to isomorphism representable as follows. So objects of CT are basically have this form. Okay. CT is bad because we are with sets, so it's set T. Right? It can be a different category, but then I need to specify when these things can be defined. So the objects of this category, of the coercive category, are sets like this. And the home set, Okay, so let's find prospective pricing category of the continuation monad. It has such things as objects and such things as homomorphism, but a homomorphism from A to B is a map from B to R to A to R. So A and B are swapped. So I define the identity map in this classic category just like usual. So they are arbitrary, they are just identity maps, but for the composition I need to take the composition in the set sense in the opposite direction. So if I have A to R B R C. So in sets, G, this is G, F, N sets, and F, G, N, C.
set.
Okay, this is clear. So, and then how I prove it. So this is the flip, which is known from Haskell. So I just flip the arguments, and how is it defined? Basically, flip of f of x, y is equal to f of yx. And obviously, flip of f is equal to f. So if we flip twice, then this version. And alright, this is polymorphic, so in principle I could write ABC and talk about several different instances of it, because I'm going to do it. And the idea that I have is so we show that flip of eta is equal to AT, and flip of F star G is equal to flip G and flip F. So I'm just gonna use this flip to so given f going from x to y to r to r to r. So if I flip it, flip f, this goes from r to y to x to r. And this is how I get the this correspondence to want, because I can switch from f's I can switch from f's, which are morphisms of my classic category, by flipping and switching to the morphisms of this form. And they are nicer because they are composed. They are composed in a standard way. Okay, let's go to 1 and 2. So let's check one. So flip. Flip theta. So eta expects, so if I flip it, I expect continuation, and then I can write down some other parameter x. So, and using the semantics of flip, what I have is eta x of k. And that we know is equal to k of x.
If you apply k to identity, you get k, and then you apply x, and it is k of x, which is what we have.
So this is just the same as identity for k.
This is identity of k of x. Yeah. So and then we can do the second. So, okay, the second is a bit longer, but it's not long. So we do flip x star g. We also apply it to x and y. Or maybe it's better to take also k and x. Okay, so what is that? That's this thing, fg with the argument slope. Then it's like this. And then we need the definition of the quasi star. Is next. Then I can, I think I can now fold it somehow, g of x, and here flip f Yeah. Right, this is the same. So, and this is each reduction. I can move this y because it's necessary. And then this is flip G F K and then X. So this is the same as flip G. Okay, so and now with this these two properties, 1 and 2, it's very easy to prove monobloss because, for example, f star eta star is equal to flip eta. First, we need to write it like this, ID. So then flip eta star ID. So and this is right, so I just added this ID here because it's a category, and then here I used this property 2, basically, here. And then here I used the property 1, and here I just canceled this ID, and this less set is by the fact that flip is inverse itself. So, and in a similar way, I can prove associativity, which is usually hard. So I start with this thing again, and then I add what I need here. And then I add two flips. Okay, now I use this property two times. Alright, so I remove the store and flip everything. Now I can use the associativity rule because now I'm in the normal category. And now I do everything in reverse order. Right, so okay, I'm best informed later about why the classic category is equivalent to the category, the classic category of the which I have explained, because I need to explain what isomorphism's categories is, which I don't want to do, but I think intuitively it's clear that this flip, if you just take the classic category that you take by, get by definition, and apply flip to all functions, then you essentially get the category which I described, and that's isomorphic, because flip goes back and forth, so it's evidently an isomorphism. So flip really just produces an alternative description of the same category, but in a more convenient way. And this laws really show that classic composition transformed into a usual composition, and modular flipping. Right, and I wanted to show you some example. Thank you. So even if I wanted to avoid the continuation moment, that's difficult to do. Well, I could do it, of course. But even if I don't like the way it's used in programming, it's still a very important moment. And, it's important in mathematics, for example, because it arises there too. It produces various sorts of dualities which are relevant from a mathematical point of view. I have to pull it down, yes. So
I'm thinking about it.
Huh? It's not so much rich. Yeah, so basically I wanted to show you something simpler, we can use continuation by loading this module in Haskell. So enter just close this one. So basically, that's somehow hidden now, I think. So defined in Haskell as a monad transformer, so that's defined as quant t, and then it's a similar thing as with the state monad. So first state transformer is defined, and then it just applied to identity. So it doesn't really show us the type. Well, okay, so that's. That's the type which it uses to define the continuation monad transformer. So it's parameterized by some monad M, and to match what I've just discussed, we need to take M equal to identity. So it belongs to all these classes, and so right. Basically, the important thing for us is this. Sorted. No, it's sorted. I don't see. So. So this this function is important for us. Because okay, so maybe I just start with an example. So I want to program something like this, run point. Point k2. Right, I can do this. Yes. So what does it do? It basically, so this point adds a constructor over this thing, over this function type which we used here, and run course point removes the constructor, so just as usual. And basically we can question the type of this. So that's a simple element of this monad which we just created. So how we create it, we just say, well, give me a continuation, and we apply this continuation to 2. And so this print is the function which is passed as the initial continuation. So because it's not like with state monad when you can just remove the constructor and print something out, because you would get a pair. So here we would get a function type, and every computation would expect a continuation. So I always need to supply something to it. And what I supply is a print function. So it basically calls by k with a print function, so it prints 2. Now I can chain it, right? Because now I know that this is monad, and I can chain it with something like this, lambda x, and then I take point. K of x plus 2, something like that. Now some brackets moving. Still no. Image if you want. Ah, maybe it expects. It expects a bracket here. So some of the brackets are not needed. It's probably not needed. I'm not sure. Right, anyway, so we start. We'll start with this print function, and basically we're supposed to read it from right to left. So this thing on the right, it transforms my continuation, which is a print. So, and the last clause says, okay, given x, call k with x plus 1 and print. So k is at that position print, so it prints x plus y, where x is passed from the context. And the context is defined before, so we know that we have x in the from the previous iteration, from the previous part of the binding, and I can chain it a little bit more. So basically, I can add something like. Times
you have to do it one bracket by one.
Here?
If you remove one of the brackets after x plus 2.
Yes. Yeah, indeed. Alright, so what we have done here is so we started with 2 and then added 2 and multiplied by 3, so we got 12. And right, so we can simplify this a lot. Well, basically, we can replace this by return. It's still working. So because basically one can notice that what happens there is this we're calling the iter, and then we can do the same here. X plus 2. Yeah. So this is equivalent. And here. Yeah. So this is a chain of returns, and I think it also explains why it works like this. Because from the monad, so from this high level perspective, you can basically here just apply the monad laws, and so basically 2 is substituted in x plus 2. So you would get return 4, and 4 is substituted in x times 3, and you would get 12. So if you're abstracted like this, then you don't need to know what the monad is. It's just sufficient to know that it's a monad, and all the monads in this respect are behave the same. And in this sense, how you use it, this continuation monad. So basically, you do not abuse the fact that you have the access to the continuation. So you're supposed to write down your progress in such style where you do not have an explicit access to the continuation, because continuation basically enters the access to the metrics, and you can manipulate everything. And of course, sometimes you want it, and then you use the function which is called callCC, and showed you the profile callCC. So this is pretty involved. So mind you, we've got this type here, and M of B is itself a monad. So if you replace this M by the continuation monad, which we used here.
Sorry.
Then what you would have would be a very lengthy type. So it's easier to explain how this works by example. And by example, it works somehow like this. Basically, I can wrap my computation in inside this pulse cc command, and then I need to write an argument here. So one on the bracket. Oh, okay. So right, I can mechanically modify my program. Basically, if I have a program, I can plug it inside of this call CC, or apply call CC function, and add an additional abstraction. So I have this red argument, and if you look at the type again, this is what it expects. So this was my original program, and this is the type of the red that I've added. So, and if I just do it like this, if I just added this red, and then the behavior of the program is the same. So, and the point is, you can use this red to quickly finish your computation, for example. So, and this function called CC is an acronym for call discard continuation, because the continuation is given to the program. So at the place where you run, you call CC, so the continuation is print. So because you've got call CC applied to some program, and the continuation, so the continuation is print. And then there can be arbitrary big program inside call CC, and it works until at some place you call the red. And red recalls the continuation which you had on the very outside. So this continuation is passed from one place of the program to the other. It gets updated, but if you call red, then you use the continuation from the very outside. Like I can, for example, use it somewhere here, for example. So I can call red, and return to, yes. So it's a bit like magic. So at this point, basically, since I've used the strong prompt, this call CC applied to print. So at the place where I can read, it grabs the continuation which was passed to the call CC. And that was print, and in particular, in this program, I just print to, no matter what current continuation is. So I just drop it. So I can probably print x plus 2. Right, this is 4. So the rest of the program is discarded, even though I'm waiting there for another x to do something else. That doesn't happen because the program is called the call CC takes care of this. So that's like a basic example. Maybe I don't know. try to come up with something more interesting next time. Okay, I think we can finish there.
Most of the applications are performance enhancements. At least that I know we looked at and use configurations you don't have to implement.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. So I think depends who you're speaking with. So there are people who advertise advertise continuations. But to me, it's like an old-fashioned, more or less. Well, unless you use it for optimization, yes. But then for optimization, you're not going to read the code which you optimized. I mean, so if you look at this from the historical perspective, and then the scientists have been concerned about how they can do various things in a functional style. And so Lisp, which existed before Haskell, tried to do something that Haskell does more successfully, in my opinion. So, and basically they had a purely functional language plus continuations. And they use the continuation for modeling everything. So, and that's also the reason why, from the theoretical perspective, continuation model is important, because in certain sense it can model any other model. So it's very expressive. So, yeah, right.